themselves rather than Israel. Recent polling shows a majority of Jews identify as Democrats. Sagar Meghani at the White House.
Protesters in Hong Kong carried a message to commuters today, the one-month anniversary of a subway station attack by suspected gang members. Pro-democracy activists are demanding an independent investigation of that event. President Trump and Venezuela socialist leader Nicolas Maduro are both confirming that the Trump administration is talking with officials of the Maduro regime in Caracas. Mr. Trump did not identify the Venezuelan officials involved, saying only that the discussions are at a very high level. Gene Randall, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
I'm very confident because the ingredients are in place. We're reaching more children. The surveillance... The structure is very robust, and resources are made available to ensure that vaccines that are required get to the children.
That's Dr. Tanji Fancho on the prospects of keeping Nigeria free of the wild polio virus. Details coming up. Also, Rwanda has introduced the use of electric motorcycles in line with the country's efforts to protect the environment. And Liberian President George Weah wants to reduce term limits for the presidency, representatives, and senators. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the council is Sudan took further steps in its transition towards civilian rule today by swearing in a new sovereign council and appointing a prime minister, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who already headed the Transitional Military Council, TMC. He was sworn in as chairman of the new council. The body replaces the TMC that took charge after months of deadly street protests brought down longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir in April. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with Nuhazin, a Sudanese visiting professor at Rice University in Texas and a spokesperson for Freedom and Change Forces, about prospects and challenges of transition to democracy in Sudan.
What makes me hopeful? In the beginning, this revolution has a lot of pitfalls and some obstacles, but people managed to cover it. People insisted and they encouraged each other to continue. You know? And that was led by the Sudanese Professional Association under the umbrella of the Freedom and Change Forces. But by the end, the will of the people, Sudanese people themselves, that's what makes me really hopeful. They really now very aware about what they have, about their rights, about their strength to change their destiny, you know, in Sudan.
As the Sudanese agreement was signed with much celebration, pro-democracy movement is still feeling that Bashir's regime was so deeply entrenched that it would take time to dismantle its political network. Is that a real threat to a successful transition to democracy in Sudan?
Yes. But given the reality now in Sudan, the deep state or the Bashir regime of the former totalitarian regime existed for 30 years, as you know, and it still existed in all kinds of our governmental or society institutions and all offices. And they still exist and, of course, will work hard to violate attempts to bring peace and or to revive the economy. But at the same time, given the reality of the events and what happened in the past 8 months, the removal of this blind state and concerted efforts of the transitional governments now to implement the emergency plan that was already prepared by the forces of freedom and changing when they made the declaration will be implemented by the executive council. And we do trust the executive council to manage this deep state. And, of course, by the cooperation with the Sovereign Council, as you know.
There are some pitfalls that can derail such transition, like Islamists in the army, political Islam in the country. Don't you think these are also hurdles to democracy in Sudan?
No, no, not at all. Because people, you know, experience this kind of Islamic divisions and parties in Sudan, and they had the chance already for 30 years to do whatever it takes to make Sudan better and or to prepare better future for Sudan, but they failed to for that, you know, and it was like all of kind of corruption, violation against humanity, you know, all kind of using their authorities for their own benefit. So people now, they're very aware about this kind of what we call Islamic division inside Sudan.
So who could domestically obstruct the roadmap and lead a counter-revolution, especially with the rising influence of General Dagalo?
Many leaders. You don't have to give a specific name for that, you know. All of those icons from the totalitarian regime will be set or present for free trial. This is number one. For the rest of them that is still free, for the coming few months, we will see what's going on with their future, you know, in Sudan. But regardless, we still know that they are still there. But if you are talking about Deglo or Hemiti, as you said, and this counter-revolution, so the issue of justice in the transitional government now is a fundamental issue. There will be independent investigation commission to look for all kinds of crimes. So if Deglo or anybody else inside the Sovereign Council or in anywhere, that will not be beyond the law from any kind of accountability for any reason. So even Deglo or anybody else.
Some experts fear the outside influence of counter-revolution supporters like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. What's your take on that?
We suffer a lot from the counter-revolution inside Sudan and the supporter for this counter-revolution outside Sudan, like Egypt, Saudi Arabia. People in Sudan, they know who put these obstacles in our revolution track. But we trust the popular pressure. Because this popular pressure is the most assured front against the supporter for al-Bashir regime, if anything happened during the coming three years.
That was Noo Hazeen, a Sudanese visiting professor at Rice University in Texas and spokesperson for the Freedom and Change Forces. She spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. The council is expected to lead the transitional government over the next 3 years. 9 other council members also took the oath of office. Raja Nicola Abdulmasi, the only Christian and one of 2 women to be appointed to the council. She said she's honored to serve her country. She says she's not coming to represent Christians, but to serve all Sudanese people, regardless of their religion. Nicola says the council's first priority should be on silencing the guns everywhere in the country. Nicola is urging Sudanese revolutionaries to be patient as the transitional government is formed, which she hopes will rebuild the country. Mohamed Abdullah Hamdok, the Forces of Freedom and Change Coalition's appointee for Prime Minister, is expected to arrive from Ethiopia later today. One other council member also has yet to arrive from the United Kingdom for his swearing-in. Today marks 3 years since a Nigerian child was stricken with the wild polio virus, which could allow the country to be declared free of the disease. Nigeria reached that point once before, only to have more cases. VOA's Carol Pearson looks at what happened the last time and what may be different this time around.
In 2015, the World Health Organization declared Nigeria free from polio. The Global Polio Eradication Initiative, a public-private partnership that's working to end polio worldwide, called it a historic achievement in global health. Then, in 2016, 4 children were stricken with polio, and Nigeria lost its designation. This time, Dr. Tanji Funsho, who leads Rotary International's Polio Committee in Nigeria, says things are different. In a Skype interview, Funsho said that what changed between 2015 and now is that Nigeria doubled down on its efforts to eradicate polio, and he has no doubt that it will succeed.
I'm very confident because the ingredients are in place. We're reaching more children. The surveillance structure is very robust, and resources are made available to ensure that vaccines that are required get to the children.
Conflict in northeastern Nigeria, particularly in Borno State, contributed to low immunity levels because polio workers couldn't get through to vaccinate children. Carol Pandek, head of Rotary's Polio Plus program, says many more children in Borno are now immunized.
We've reduced the number of inaccessible children in Borno from around 600,000 in 2016 to around 60,000 to 70,000 right now.
Since 2016, the Nigerian government has improved surveillance and launched supplementary immunization campaigns, in addition to routine immunizations. The country has initiated strategies to inoculate even the hardest to reach children. Nigerians know about the crippling effects of polio, but many people were concerned about the vaccine. False rumors spread about what the vaccine actually did. Funcho says those fears have been put to rest.
The concerns are not about the safety of the vaccines. What we see more and more are non-compliance because of what people describe as felt needs. They wonder why they get the polio vaccine coming around so frequently, and they don't have access to other primary healthcare drugs, like anti-malarial drugs, like antidiarrheal drugs, for instance. And so they want you to provide that as well.
Funcho says those needs are now being met. If there are no new confirmed cases in the next couple of months, Nigeria and all of Africa could be declared free of the wild polio virus sometime next year. Then only two countries, Pakistan and Afghanistan, will have the wild polio virus in circulation. If the virus can be beat in those countries, the world will be rid of polio. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Also in Nigeria, police have rearrested a suspected kidnapped kingpin who escaped in a shootout between the army and police. Hamsi Bala Wadume was tracked down in a hideout in Kano State. He had been arrested earlier this month, but 2 weeks ago, soldiers attacked a police unit, transporting him, and three police officers and a civilian were shot dead. The army said the soldiers believed that kidnappers, not police officers, were in the vehicle. Yesterday, police tweeted out a video of Wadume saying that soldiers helped him escape. Wadume has been on the police wanted list for several high-profile kidnappings. Wadume's escape from custody has widened the bitter long-standing rift between the police and the military. Police headquarters also demanded that the military explain why troops seized Wadume and how he was freed from military custody. Seventeen past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Rwanda has introduced the use of electric motorcycles in line with the country's efforts to protect the environment. Passengers and motorcyclists say these vehicles have dramatically changed the background. Eugene Uimana has more details from Kigali.
So, basically on electric motors...
45-year-old James Musisi has been in the taxi motor business for 12 years. He's among 10 operators who are in the first phase of switching to electric motorcycles.
It's not noise, so it is good for the people with problems of cardiac diseases, cannot disturb them. Even the passengers at the bike can keep on calling, receiving calls, to doing their business.
One motorcycle cost $1,300 US. For John Musisi, this is cheaper compared with $1,600 US for gasoline bikes.
This bike is very cheap according to the expenses. There's no need of oil change. There's no chain. There's no drum brakes. This one uses disc brakes, and it lasts long comparing to the drum brakes. So according to expenses, this one requires less. While those that use fuel lubricants, every week we have to change the oil.
Another 600 electric motorcycles are under construction. At the two charging stations in Kigali, a driver swaps out an exhaust battery for a fresh one that can run about 45 miles. The price is equal to the same in petrol for that distance. In 2016, entrepreneurs from four countries formed a startup called Ampersand with a mission to transform Rwanda into a mass market for commercial electric motorcycles. Josh Ware, the company's chief executive officer, says the e-motors have a great potential in a country that leads in environmental initiatives.
For electricity, we found that the grid is sufficiently reliable in Kigali. There has been a lot of investment made in new transmission lines. There are some lines in particular that are operating well under capacity, and where REG has indicated that would be good sites for us.
Engineer Coleta Luhamia, Director General of the Rwanda Environment Management Authority, calls it a milestone in Rwanda's target to be an important accelerator in the environmental protection movement worldwide.
So I don't see why Rwanda should be behind. I think it's the right time that Rwanda should also come forward and take this move forward, and we call each and everybody of us to also embrace it and go together.
President Paul Kagame recently declared that his government is going to replace all motorcycles with electric ones. He says, "We will find a way to replace the ones you have now. Tax motor operators, please, we urge you to help us when the phase-out process comes." In other initiatives to help the environment and keep the streets clean, Rwanda has banned the use of plastic bags and the use of other single-use plastic materials, including water bottles. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Cameroon's Anglophone separatists have attacked towns and villages in protest of a military tribunal giving their leader a life sentence. Cameroon's military says at least two people have been killed in Bamenda and six wounded in a shootout with separatists. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the town of Buda.
24-year-old Cameroonian food seller Donatus Ngwa on Wednesday fled fighting in the northwestern English-speaking town of Bamenda to French-speaking Buda. He says separatist fighters started chasing people off Bamenda streets on Tuesday night. Today they were shooting indiscriminately in the air, says Ngwa, assaulting those who disobeyed them and ordering everyone to leave the streets. Ngwa is one of close to 100 Cameroonians who escaped to Buda since Tuesday when the Yaounde military tribunal gave lifetime prison sentences to separatist leader Ayuk Tabe Julius and nine supporters. Separatists on social media ordered everyone in Cameroon's English-speaking western regions to stay at home as a sign of protest over the sentences. They also vowed to step up their fight to make Cameroon's English-speaking regions independent of the French majority. The governor of the English-speaking Northwest region, Deben Chofo, called on the population to be calm and work with the military.
They can be assured of the availability of their administrative authorities and the security services to help them. I'm asking the population of the Northwest region to remobilize themselves to shun off the region those that are terrorizing the population, threatening them.
The Yaounde military tribunal found separatist leader Julius and his nine supporters guilty of secession, terrorism and hostility against the state of Cameroon. The tribunal ordered them to spend life in prison and pay a fine of $50 million. Rights groups and other critics condemned the court's ruling, saying it would impede efforts to end the conflict, which has left 2,000 people dead in the past 3 years. Activist Edwin Faure says the sentences risk inflaming further violence.
Will not be surprised if the violence this time will be very disastrous and must stretch a little bit further into the other parts of the country. Let the head of state do something about this. The time is now to think on another strategy to calm down tensions.
Violence erupted in Cameroon's English-speaking regions in 2016 when teachers and lawyers protested alleged discrimination at the hands of the French-speaking majority. The government responded with a crackdown that sparked an armed movement for an independent English-speaking state. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Buda, Cameroon.
Liberian President George Weah wants to reduce term limits for the presidency, representatives, and senators. Moses Garaziwi reports from Monrovia.
President George Weah assembled dozens of legislators over the weekend, urged them to cut their years elected officials serve. Weah asked for a constitutional change to reduce the term of the president from 6 years to 5 years. He also wants representatives to serve 5 years instead of six and senators to sit for 7 years instead of nine. Deputy Presidential Press Secretary Smith Tobe says the president intends is to push officials to begin serving the people from the day they assume office. Tobe says often elected officials neglect their duties and only begin actually working at the close of their terms, which he says hamper development.
For example, a senator will perhaps wait for the last 2 years of his 9 years to start to take development to his county. That is not fair in terms of representation. Some lawmakers tend to be complacent. They got 6 years. They could start working in the last 3 years of their administration. That is also not being fair to the electorates. The president, sometimes 6 years, and they start to work maybe in the last 2 years. If you start to work immediately upon your election as of day one, know that you got 5 years, you would have to take some time to play it around. And I think that once that is passed, it gives extra burden and attention to those who will be elected to those positions. They will start to work immediately upon their election.
Some legislators who attended the meeting praised the president for coming out to explain his intent on some of the legislations he wants them to pass. Representative Richard Nagwe-Kun thinks it's the perfect way to understand the laws they are to deliberate on.
We embrace the idea. I would say it was first of its kind since the president took over to have this kind of coordinated and very reconciled retreat, because we all interacted with various things that we're not satisfied with. And I think he looked in that direction to see how best we can work together instead of one group of governments strangling the other branch of government.
Representative Francis Dopo from Rewaji County thinks the best way to solve some of Liberia's major issues is to rewrite the constitution.
Some people could vote for the proposition from the point of anger, from the point of political oppositioners, from the point of political favoritism. You know, so as a lawmaker, I just think that the people view matter. But I can tell you the best thing to do is to rewrite the constitution.
But his colleague Vincent Willie of Grand Bassa County said rewriting the constitution would take time and resources.
Rewriting the constitution is very much germane. It is important. But given the time interval, you cannot rewrite your constitution for just 6 months. You're talking about a whole year. It's a process. It's not even. So I think by changing some of the proposition and making sure that at least the law is relaxed and flexible, the next step will be reviewing or rewriting the entire constitution.
This is not the first time the idea of cutting terms has come up. A constitutional review committee under former President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf made similar recommendation after doing a nationwide consultation, but their recommendations went nowhere. We are also used the gathering to unveil 25 proposed bills, most of which concerns constitutional amendments. For instance, he is asking for a change to allow Liberians to hold dual citizenship. Moses Gazel, VOA News, Monrovia.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, historically black colleges and universities in the United States have also educated prominent Africans.